Welcome back to Sherry Miss. We ended the last segment having a conversation with Nick. Unfortunately, Nick has some questions that he'd like us to address, so Nick has agreed to stay on with us, and we'll do our best to answer whatever questions or make comments on whatever it is that you're concerned about. So, Nick, the floor is yours.
So why do Jews groom the way they groom? Those hairs on the sideburns. And do you also have those hairs hanging down with a little beard and stuff? What the heck?
Yeah, I'm with my little black hat and my... You probably heard me. The answer is no, and I'll answer the rest of it here just in a second. You probably heard me speak disparagingly about religious dress, that if I see somebody dressed up in their in religious garb, I just smirk and I just, you know, I immediately think poorly of them for wearing religious dress. It doesn't matter if they're Amish or they're Muslim or they're the Haredi Jews. The Jews that you're speaking of would be considered ultra Orthodox. The rabbinic. All Judaism is rabbinic today. I would say the time of Akiba, and around 120 CE. Judaism became the only surviving form of Judaism. The Sadducees kind of had a very liberal political, social view of Judaism. They were done away with. The Essenes had a kind of an aesthetic, you withdraw from society, kind of almost a monkish view of Judaism. And they viewed that the chief priest had to be the tribe of Levi, which is what Yahweh says, and they were eliminated. They're gone. So the only form of Judaism that's practiced today is rabbinic Judaism, Pharisaic Judaism.
So everything that comes out with the hairs and everything else,
yes,
is just something they pick out from Talmud or Mishnah or some other crap.
Correct. Other crap. The little curly Q that they have coming down the side, and their black hats and their black their black suits
Am I glad I don't have to wear that white or black head on top of my head? Because he's gonna stay there. I mean, there's almost no hair, and I have no idea how the hell would I actually get the thing stick to the top of that.
I'm just glad I don't have to wear a get up, because I am so opposed to religious attire. The bottom line answer for Yahweh on everything, Nick, and you've heard this before, but I want to reinforce it for everybody. Yahweh's Torah teaching is not only uplifting, it's liberating. God didn't establish a bunch of rules for us to go around like morons and dress like religious idiots. In fact, God, when he spoke of against the rabbinic leadership, he called them broods of vipers, of poisonous snakes. So God says, you dress up, you play dress up, you take the most important seats at every meeting, you act like big shots, you've got your big long prayers to be seen in public. He says, you're all a complete group of frauds, you're total hypocrites,
I got my question answered. Now the different question.
Okay.
How did you come up with the name Yara? Where did you get the name? Did the God give it to you? Did you just pull it out from the book, or where?
Just first to answer why I chose a name is that I wanted to be irrelevant. I mean, that was the purpose of choosing a name that's not my own name. Because if you were to Google my name, you'll find hundreds of thousands of comments and blogs and articles and everything else in the world. And I just wanted to be honest.
You're a famous guy, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm a famous guy. And so it was just so much easier because I noticed one of the things in talk radio is that it really is an arena. It's kind of like politics. It's an arena of ego, and everybody tries to promote a picture of themselves and their name, and they try to develop a following for them, and it becomes just this egotistical charade, and that's the last thing I wanted.
Whether they will follow Greg or Yara would not just make no difference. What do you choose
if I go by just a Hebrew word as opposed to my name, then the advantage is that I can honestly say that my goal is to be irrelevant. I don't want anybody to follow me.
Well, even Jesus couldn't accomplish what you trying to, which is make him irrelevant according to what he taught the people.
Right.
I mean, even now everyone, you know, the name Yara, which is just Hebrew word,
right,
still can be corrupted and
right,
be used just like they did with Yahusha.
Absolutely.
It can become Jesus or whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, as you know, Jesus is a total corruption, has no basis in reality, and the name is Yahusha. Yahusha as a name is really important. And it's true that even Yahusha, as a diminished manifestation of God, couldn't achieve what he most wanted to achieve, which is he even wanted to be as anonymous as absolutely possible because he was trying to direct our attention to Yahweh, and that's my goal as well. Okay, why did I choose Yada? Was the question there. The Hebrew word for to know, and it means to know in a relational sense, and the entire purpose of the program is I want to encourage people to come to know Yahweh. And so yada as a verb meaning to know seemed like an ideal verb to take as a name for a program encouraging people to come to know Yahweh. He's worth knowing.
So then when you're going to see the maker, mm-hmm, is he going to greet you as Greg or Yara?
You know, the beauty of it is that he has told us that when we come into his presence, he's going to give us a name. And I know what it's all names are going to be Ben, which means son of, or Bena, daughter of Yahweh. But I think he is, as I read through his testimony, he's going to give us a name which he thinks is fitting of our unique personalities, and the more passionate we are, the more devoted we are to discovery and to knowing him, the better. But no, he's going to give us a name. So then I don't know.
To your family, mm-hmm, and close friends, you a Yara or a Greg? What do they call you?
I have no one that calls me Yara. I remain Hey You or Craig or Dad
or
Honey.
Name, then.
Yeah. That's all. The entire purpose was that when I rewrote Yada Ya, and I rewrote Intro to God, I rewrote an introduction that began by saying, I'm an irrelevant individual. I am wholly irrelevant. This is not about me. And I'm going to use the term Yada as a nickname just to emphasize the fact that this is not about me.
So then another question. Mm-hmm. On that blog talk radio that you're doing,
right,
are you doing like one show a month there?
Mm-hmm.
Every Friday.
We do it. And by the way, there's another example of a place where you can go to the Bless Yahweh site, blessyahweh.com, which is Richard's website. At that website, He also has all of the archives for the Yada Yada Radio. And it's every Friday. We do it at live. That's a program where live is definitely better than the archives, because live there's a chat room that's associated with the program and lots of people participate in that. And that's a program where lots of people call in, but it's devoted entirely to the Torah. We don't do news on that program. Only the Torah. And it's once a week, every Friday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. 4:30 p.m. Pacific Coast Time.
Okay. You still have 40 minutes, so I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say.
Okay. I'm always happy to answer your questions, no matter how simple or profound. So if you've got another question, I'm all ears. If not, we'll go and we'll resume our criticisms of Paul and Pauline Christianity.
I'm done with questions.
Okay, all right. All right, so thank goodness we don't have the webcam and you can't see me with my little curly hair and my black hat.
Next time.
Just kidding. All right, Nick. Bye. Thank you. I would like to revisit where we were in our analysis of Paul. And the last program, I affirmed that Yahweh had indicated that Paul, like the beast, the same thing will be true of the folks, the individual known as the Antichrist to Christians. He is the Torahless one from Yahweh's perspective, also known as the beast. That he, like Paul, will be a homosexual. Now, it isn't the homosexual that makes him a beast. The fact that, I mean, it's just God provides lots of insights into the character and into the ego, into the dialogue and the approach of the Torahless one, the beast known as the Antichrist by Christians. And the textbook that he's going to use is Pauline Christianity. And so it was a fact that Yahweh wanted us to know that Paul was a homosexual. It's a fact that Yahweh felt was helpful for us to know that the beast, the Antichrist of the last days, he's the Torahless one, that he too is going to be a homosexual. That neither of those things make him the beast. Neither one of them make them a false prophet. It's just another character reference. And I think the reason that that's important is that the only reason that God's got any issue with homosexuality happens to be that the covenant is all about a man and a woman coming together to conceive children and to raise them in a loving home. Models his covenant. Now, mind you, so long as Paul wasn't a rapist, so long as he wasn't incestuous, so long as he wasn't a pedophile, as was the case with Muhammad on all three of those issues, Shaul's, depending on the Hebrew name or his taken Roman name, his sexual orientation is irrelevant up to a point. Now, it's up to a point because Paul denounces homosexuality. And if he's denouncing what he himself is, then he's a hypocrite. And therefore, that's a problem. Also, Pauline Christianity is what created all of this resentment over condemnation over everything that is sensual in nature. And it's caused generations to grow up uptight. The fact that he admits that he was a sexual pervert while establishing the basis for people to be so repressed sexually. It's a shame. I mean, a lot of the rebellion against God can be laid to Paul's feet, where, I mean, he's the one that speaks so vociferously against all forms of sensuality. And God created us to enjoy our marriages, to enjoy our husbands and wives, adding, an entire dimension to our relationships. And I think to a large degree, Paul screwed all that up. And here he's admitting that he's an uncontrolled sexual pervert. while he's the one whose rhetoric speaks against all forms of sexual perversity. It's just a pure hypocrite. But beyond all this, Paul is fast becoming a model for the man known as the Antichrist, the Torahless one. Now, on the subject of gaiety, what are we to make of the connection between Paul's uncontrollable lusts and the charities known as the gratia, or graces, in Rome? After all, these naked beauties were the pagan embodiment of not only lasciviousness, but also of homosexual sex. The indulgent, unrestrained one's fixation on death now continues. This is what he has to say, furthering his animosity towards God. We have now covered the first 8 verses of Romans 7. This is the 9th. So then, I was living apart from and without the Torah, but once having happened upon the commandment, the evil sin sprung to life again. Now, that's an interesting statement. So then, I was living apart from and without the Torah. Now, when you look at Paul's life, he was born in what is today southern Turkey, Tarsus. And his father was a Roman citizen. So he's suggesting here that he was raised a Roman apart from the Torah. Now, he claims he went into rabbinic school. He claims he was the ultimate student, the best student from the best teacher in rabbinic school, which would have been in Jerusalem. And so he would have had to travel from southern Turkey to Jerusalem. And there, as a young man, he was educated to become a rabbi. This would have been that he would have been in Jerusalem, therefore studying to be a rabbi, at the same time Yosha was delivering his Sermon on the Mountain. Now, and fulfilling the first 4 Moed Mikre. Now, it'd be interesting to note that in rabbinic school, they would not have been studying the Torah. They would have been studying the Jerusalem Talmud. They would have been studying the rabbinic teachings. Now, the rabbis were not fond of the Torah. They had their oral Torah, their own oral law that they wished to impose on people, and it was those rules that they were the most fixated upon. But Paul is saying that he was born Torahless, but that as he, using his own terms, so then I was living apart from the Torah. But then once having happened upon the commandment, so as he is now caused to read the commandment, he claims that evil then sprung to life again inside of him. That he became evil by being associated with the commandment. Now, by the way, the very commandment that he claims was the source of the evil within him doesn't exist, which tells you he is a complete fraud. We'll be back. So here is Paul again saying that before he knew the Torah, that he was raised apart from the Torah, but then he confronted the commandment. So he's not saying that he observed the Torah. He's not saying that he agreed with the Torah. He didn't say that he applied the Torah. He just said he was confronted with the commandment. So I want to go back through his statements thus far, because it's important that you know that the commandment that he's speaking of does not exist. He made it up. But now at the present time, we have been released and removed from the Torah, having died in that which inappropriately hindered and restrained us, holding us down in order to enslave us to a different and completely new spirit, and not the old, inferior, obsolete, and former age of that which was written. What therefore shall we say? The Torah is misleading, errant, and offensive. If only it were not so. Nevertheless, I would not have actually known that which was evil, sinful, and wrong, if not through the Torah. For also, lust and craving I would not have been aware of, if not for the Torah, saying, you shall not have strong desires. The Torah doesn't say that. You shall not have strong desires. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. But now, the opportunity, the excuse, and the pretext to grab hold of and to experience that which is evil, sinful, and wrong through the commandment was brought about thoroughly in me, including every and all deep desire and longing, including sexual perversion. For indeed, without the Torah, that which was and is misleading, errant, and offensive is dead and no longer an issue. So then, I was living apart from and without the Torah. But once having happened upon the commandment, the evil sin sprung to life again. It's just utterly absurd. So Paul is saying that, apart from the Torah, we wouldn't even know what evil is, so therefore sexual perversion wouldn't be evil. I wouldn't be sexually perverted if the Torah hadn't told me you ought not be sexually perverted. And then he's saying that there's a commandment that says you should not have deep desire and longing. No such commandment. I mean, even if you get past the fact that the Ten Statements aren't commandments, there's no instruction on deep desire and longing.
So wait.
And here's, go ahead.
What he's saying here is, I would have never been burned if you would have never told me that was hot. Like, hot doesn't exist if he's just not told about it?
That's his argument. And this is the founder of the largest religion in human history.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah, good luck. If you're going to trust, I mean, basically what you have here is you have Yahweh saying one thing, Yosha saying exactly what Yahweh said, and then you have Paul completely contradicting them. And the religion of Christianity is based upon Paul's complete contradiction of Yahweh and Yosha. Good luck with that, right? And his argument is, the Torah is done away with because the Torah enslaves, it's a source of evil. Because without the Torah, we wouldn't know what evil is. And it's only because the Torah tells us what evil is that we are caused to be evil. So, yeah, you have an adoptive son, Scott. If you tell your son, not safe for you to play with a loaded gun, that in your when you want to go out and play with your friends, you should not include a loaded gun in your playtime. Now, if your son then grabs a loaded gun and goes and kills a friend, do you think he would successfully be able in the court to say it's my father's fault because my father told me not to do this?
No.
That's Paul's argument.
Based on Paul's argument, I shouldn't even tell him about the gun. I shouldn't even explain what a gun is.
Because that's
then
correct.
He never has to worry about it.
Right. Then if he picked it up and he pulled the trigger and killed himself or a friend, it would be
magic.
Oh, wait a minute.
It would be magic.
There you go. It's magic. Wow. They say that confession is good for the soul, but methinks this isn't helping. Paul has again admitted that evil and sin are thriving within him, that they have sprung to life within him. He is operationally offensive and functionally errant. Now, if we are to believe Paul, a mythical commandment saying, thou shalt not be passionate, indulgent, lustful, or sexually perverted, killed him. So then, I died when was found in me the commandment. with reference to living this brought to death. So, what Paul is claiming is that a mythical commandment which says you shall not be passionate, indulgent, lustful, or sexually perverted. There are seven instructions and three statements. The statements and the instructions say absolutely nothing about being passionate, they don't even speak of perversion. So then, I died when was found in me the commandment. Now, this is a mythical commandment with reference to living. This brought death. Now, if only it had. I mean, I wish he had died. For indeed, this evil sin took hold of this opportunity through the commandment to thoroughly deceive and completely beguile me, and also through it, it killed. We're dealing with absolute insanity. He is calling the commandment that he has made up, that he says is part of the Torah, a source of evil.
That came from within him. Within him.
To deceive him and to beguile him. So, Yahweh's Torah, rather than being a source of instructions to enlighten us, to liberate us, to adopt us, is actually a series of commandments designed to completely beguile us. What God etched in stone was God's attempt to systematically entice and delude humankind.
Which every other time that we've been told something, it's coming from a messenger that spoke directly with somebody else. It's not
right.
Moshe coming up and saying, oh, I just felt this. This came from within me. There it is. I talked to you.
Yeah, actually, almost everything in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is Yahweh speaking in first person through the prophet. The prophet says, the voice of Yahweh came to me and said the following. And since it's Yahweh speaking in first person, they just simply scribe down what Yahweh said. Paul takes an entirely different point of view. He says, but I, Paul, said, and then what he has to say completely undermines everything and contradicts everything that Yahweh had to say. Jim, who called us, I don't know if it was earlier last week or the previous week from Arizona, spectacular call. I think it was earlier this week. Jim, I'm glad that you've called back.
Oh, thank you. Just a comment that you were saying that this is new to me, so it kind of struck me, that Paul, in his own words, he said he happened upon the Torah.
Right.
He was just living his own life, being religious, or happy to be Paul, until one day he actually stumbled upon the Torah.
Right.
And there's a word that I love. I've loved it for years. And you've used it a number of times. It's resonant. You can read the Talmud, or you can be religious and make all kinds of arguments and rationalize your life and everything you do, and that's fine. But for me personally, when I found the Torah, it resonated.
Yeah.
And
here Paul's saying that
it's
right. Yeah, Paul is saying, so then I was living apart from and without. This is the Greek word choris. It means disassociated from and independent of, separated and devoid of any relationship with the Torah. But once at the point that I happened upon, this is Irkomai, I came to the commandment, the regulation, the injunction, the evil sin sprung to life again. So Paul's experience with the Torah, therefore, is the opposite of yours, the opposite of mine. When he confronted the Torah, came to the Torah, he found that the Torah became this source of pure evil that beguiled him, that enslaved him, that killed him, and that caused him to be perverted. And you and I read the Torah, and the God that we met there, we came to respect. And the teaching that was there resonated with us. Our experience is exactly the opposite of Paul's.
A resonance can be either pleasant and pleasing, or it can be damaging and harming.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Paul found the Torah to be damaging.
Yeah, and harming.
Right.
That's so
unfortunate.
Yeah. And what's so amazing here is that he was so adverse to the Torah that rather than seeing the Torah for what it is, which is fatherly advice to Yah's children so that they might live more fulfilling and productive lives, Paul sees it as God literally beguiling humankind, of God hindering humankind, of God depressing and corrupting humankind and causing humankind to be perverted.
Yeah, it sounds like he just went right back and embraced religion for the teaching.
Yes.
Rationalizing.
Yeah. I don't know how you could read the Torah and come to that conclusion. I mean,
you're right. I think there's some insanity involved.
Yeah, there has to be insanity.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that, and Jim, stay with us to the next segment, but that's the thing that is so overwhelming to me, is that the more I read the Torah, the more I come to love it and its author. Welcome back to Shatter Amos. We're having a conversation with Jim in Arizona, who has expressed my view as well, that Paul's experience with the Torah when he first encountered the Torah is the antithesis of ours. When I started reading the Torah and thinking about it, Jim, one of the first things that struck me is Yahweh getting down on his knees to lift Adam up because he loved him.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't strike me as a God that is trying to pervert Adam or... And then you think of the fact that Yahweh is the architect of life. And according to Paul, he is actually the architect of death. Why would you create life if what you really liked was death?
Well, even like his name
in
symbolic Hebrew.
Yeah. Yes.
Font.
Yes.
The arm reaching down. I mean, it's not a fist reaching down. There's
open hand, right?
Open hand, and what is the very first character doing? Reaching up towards the hand,
right?
How does that symbolically have anything to do with domination?
Yeah, did you read anything about the Garden of Eden experience with Adam and Yahweh, that where God said, "You get down on your knees, you obey me, you worship me"?
I thought he walked with him.
Yeah, he walked with him. They sat down side by side to examine life and the animals that God had created. They had long walks, long walks.
I'm still not sure if he was in physical form or if it was a myth. Or I'm still chewing on a lot of this. But.
Yeah, the how interacted with Adam. My conclusion, and it doesn't mean it's right, was that it's one of the seven corporeal manifestations of Yahweh, that Yahweh has been with his creation, humankind, on earth as a corporeal representation six times already. The seventh time will be when he returns in 2033, and one of those times where he engaged and walked with and talked with and ate with and had chats with Adam was in a corporeal form. I'm happy to be wrong on that. It's just that when I looked throughout the entirety of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, I came to the fact that, well, there's been six already and there's going to be a seventh, and so it seems to fit quite well. You know, when I started, you start reading through the Torah, and then you come to the story of him reaching out to Abram. It became Abraham. and offering to adopt him and to empower him and to enrich him and to perfect him and to provide a home for him, and how the first child of the covenant is named Laughter, and how he includes Sarah in this whole discussion. And even tells Abraham at one point, you know, listen to your wife. I find an extremely approachable, fun-loving, generous God.
The more you look into it from the proper perspective, mm-hmm. the more you will see. You have to get away from Christianity or any religion.
You really do.
And just think of it as a father-son or a father-daughter relationship.
Yeah.
If you can, not everyone can, if you can put
Correct.
Yourself in that perspective, your eyes will be open to so many.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it even goes one step beyond father-son, father-daughter. And while that is the overwhelmingly accurate perspective, and I would agree with you, this is a very rich father-son, father-daughter relationship. And that Yahweh speaks of Abraham as being his very dear and close friend. And I think that Yahweh's depictions throughout the Torah prophets and Psalms of Dod, who obviously is a son, is a child of the covenant, but they were dear and close friends. Yahweh is so approachable that he even wants to, he loves the father metaphor because he can get down on his knees and lift us up, and he can devote himself to enriching our lives as fathers would do in a loving way. But he wants to be our best friend.
Yeah.
The more I'm exposed to who he am, to who he is, what he has done, what he is offering, what he has said, I went from coming to like him, to respecting him, to falling in love.
Yeah. Finding comfort.
Yeah, finding comfort.
Comfortable.
Yeah, and finding an entire celebration of life. Thank you, Jim. I hope to hear from you again soon.